Morning, members.
Good morning, Chair.
I was speaking with someone about 2 seconds ago, 2 minutes ago, about, well, you know, the snow obviously is going to have an impact on the attendance and this morning, but I think perhaps it had more to do with our first 8 o'clock morning meeting of the session. I suspect we'll have some other committee members coming in. My kudos to Representative Ornstein for putting us over the top today. You got us to quorum. Very good. You just barely beat out Representative Grayling for that honor. So we'll see if we'll get a little competition going here today. Members, we have actually a pretty simple agenda today, but a pretty full agenda. It is my hope that we will spend some time updating each other on the work that a number of you all have been involved in over the past several months. This has been a very busy group of committee members. You've broken up into different work groups during the last several months. Some of you, in addition to that, have been working pretty frantically, energetically, I should say, perhaps frantically. We will be working frantically soon, energetically on your own bills and perhaps in tandem with other members as well. So my hat's off to all of you for taking your responsibilities seriously in terms of being a 12-month, 24/7 responsibility. I think it's a good thing for us to constantly be paying attention to education policy issues throughout the course of the year. Today's agenda, we're going to hear briefly from the different working groups that have been gathered under the aegis of this committee and as well as under Representative Grayling's committee. We're also going to hear a presentation from Dr. Roger Bybee, who's Director Emeritus of DSCS, and he's going to tell us what DSCS is because I haven't figured that out yet. And then we'll have a bill from Representative Bly with an early childhood education program and some licensure issues that came up in regards to legislation that we passed last year. As you all have probably figured out, things are most likely going to move pretty quickly in this session. We have the early committee deadlines, being a policy committee, March 14th, is that right? Our first deadline. So it's a month from now, and I think that means we have 8, maybe 9 scheduled committee meetings plus you. 8 or 9 committee regular meetings scheduled. So we're going to work, I think, awfully hard to make sure that members have a fair shot of having their bills heard. But I'm going to apologize ahead of time. I suspect we're not going to be able to hear all the bills that have been introduced simply because of the short time frame that we have. We'll be moving bills through here. Obviously, this is a major. This is not a major finance year for the legislature. I know that a number of you have already introduced policy bills, and it would be my intent to move those bills to the degree that we can straight to the floor for action. Obviously, some of you may have some bills that have financial or finance considerations, and so we'll be moving some of those over to Representative Grayling and Representative Flowers Committee as well. So why don't we get started, members? We have 3 sets of minutes, and I'm going to need a motion. Let me get the dates here. March 23rd, May 10th. Can we do these all at once? Yeah. We have minutes from January 25th, May 10th, and March 23rd. Would someone be so kind as to move that? Dietrich moves adoption of those minutes. Any discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. We're going to start with presentations from our interim working groups, and I don't think all our presenters are here, so we may need to jump around during the agenda for this. Is Kathy here? Representative Ryder, I'm going to start with you. You're not a member of this committee, so that'll free you up to get on to your other responsibilities this morning. But I feel like you're an honorary member of this committee. We've been working awfully close and awfully hard over the last several months, and I really am greatly appreciative of your leadership and the incredible amount of time you've put into this effort over the last several months. So thank you. Welcome to the committee, and give us a brief overview and outline of what you and the working group have been up to.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I appreciate this opportunity, and I was told that we were allotted 5 minutes, so I'll do my best to represent the work of our committee in that time. You have a brief summary in one of your handouts of our work, but I'll just remind you that this committee was actually constituted by Representative Mariani in response to what was called the report card legislation, House File 2021, Senate File 1904, which became a part of the Education Omnibus Bill. That, in addition to removing the 5 stars from the report card, that legislation also moved to constitute an advisory group to evaluate potential indicators, report card indicators, that we might move forward to have multiple measures in our report card process. Because the funding for that initiative was vetoed, Representative Mariani chose an alternate path to achieve the objective, and this working group was a piece of that path. So you see that our membership included Representative Hosh, Norton, Rep. Peterson, Slocum, and Wardlow. And in addition, through Representative Mariani's leadership, we did this work completely in partnership with the Senate. Senator Sandy Rummel chaired the committee from the Senate side, and every step of the way we worked with the Senate on this. So we have come to the same position. I'll just briefly take you through our process, and then if there are any questions, I'd certainly be glad to entertain those. The first thing we did was build a partnership with the University of Minnesota's College of Education and Human Development in order to invite them to serve in an advisory capacity so that we could take advantage of their professional and research expertise as we pursued looking at additional indicators. And that team worked with us throughout the process. And for every public meeting we had a pre-meeting and a post-meeting. So there were a lot of meetings of various sorts throughout. We held 4 public meetings. The first, we invited the Department of Education to share with us the report card in its current status and how they were looking to the future to move forward any changes in it. We took testimony from superintendents and the parent representative. The second meeting, we proceeded to ask the question, what indicators might we use in moving forward this discussion? And we put out that question to as many groups and individuals as we could. We took 4 hours of testimony from 18 different individuals and organizations on that question of what indicators we might consider. So then in our third public meeting, the University of Minnesota team, who had been with us through all that testimony, recommended 3 indicators out of that large group that were the strongest possibility to move forward, that were the most research-based. So we took that recommendation from the U of M team at that point, and then we created an interim step because we felt it was really important that each of those recommendations be further vetted in a professional manner. So we created 3 expert advisory groups for each of those recommendations, and those groups met in over a 3-week period a number of times depending on the group. And then we moved forward with the recommendations. We had a public meeting that carried forward our 3 recommendations, and those areas are growth and value added, completion of rigorous coursework, and climate safety and student engagement. So those will be the recommendations that we will move forward in legislation this session. Those advisory groups that have worked with us are still meeting and still working closely with us as we shape the final legislation, and you will hear from them when the legislation is moved forward. I take any questions or...
Super. Thank you, Representative Breiner. Are there any questions or observations for Representative Breiner? While you think about that, let me just say, let me thank you again for your leadership on this. I think you detailed a very thorough process that you and Senator Rummel led. It was top-notch. You had, you broadly, both of you broadly engaged a number of folks from throughout the state in some pretty, intense, deep reflection on the function of the report card and what its best features could be in terms of helping schools learn from each other, but also having us as lawmakers learn about our schools in a way that we can be helpful to them, which I think really is originally the major intent of the report card, beyond just a mechanism for reporting, really being a place in which folks like you and I and others here can ascertain broad policy help and direction that we can help provide our schools.
And members, I think you'll see as the legislation is presented that this is meant to be a complementary and supportive vision. It's not a challenge to the No Child Left Behind portion of the report card. That stands on its own. It's meant to broaden the state's, both the state's vision and responsibility for school performance measures so that we might have a more robust and complete view of our school performance.
Mr. Breiner, and I'm particularly excited about what can come forward from the value-added growth model that the MAG group developed for us. I think it's going to potentially help us to have a better, if you will, diagnostic tool that can help us identify effective practices throughout the state, to better inform our policy, but also so that schools can connect with one another and teach each other. And I envision a pretty robust long-term agenda for the Municipal Department of Education in terms of helping to facilitate that learning across schools and with the legislature.
And again, I think you'll see as the legislation is presented that this is meant to be a complementary growth model. The department worked on their own growth model in relation to NCLB, and the requirements of adequate yearly progress, and I'm sure you'll hear further about that, but this is a growth model more akin to the type of growth measure that might be available through the Northwest Educational Assessment, but it's based on the MCAs so that we can move forward with it within our current testing parameters.
And finally, Representative Breiner, let me just acknowledge the assistance for the University of Minnesota. They stepped up pretty big. We had several meetings over in their shop early on in this process, and they lent quite a hand and a number of researchers and staff people to help us shape our work. And so I just want to publicly acknowledge their support. And again, re-emphasize the collegial relationship that you have with the Senate in doing this work. I think one of the things you suffered from last year was perhaps not as close vetting throughout the legislative session with the Senate, and we saw the sometimes unfortunate, difficult outcomes of that when we got to conference committee and realized we were speaking two different languages on a number of very important issues. I look forward to your bill. We will have a very full hearing sometime soon on your bill, and I hope that members will come prepared to fully vet that and also to fully learn from the new learnings that you and the group have uncovered.
And just a footnote on the process, Mr. Chair. The value of having the interim committee work is we really were able to delve into both additional testimony from a broad range of organizations and the research base for each of these recommendations, and I think you'll see that when the recommendations come forward. If we had tried to do this work during session, it would not be of the quality of depth or breadth that you'll see. So thank you for the opportunity to do that work.
Thank you, Representative Breiner. Let's see, who else do we have here? David's still working on this. Oh, Representative Bly. Let me ask Representative Bly to come forward as well. Representative Bly is not a member of this committee, but he is, like Representative Breiner, a member of a education committee. He introduced a bill last year that I thought was pretty intriguing and raised some pretty deep suggestions for us in terms of fully exploring it. We didn't have the time during regular session to be able to do that, and so I asked Representative Wye to also head up a working group focused on alternative schools and assessment, state assessments of alternative schools. And I had the privilege, Representative Wye, to sit in on a number of your committees, very well run, good information, and I understand you also have a bill coming forward, and so we'll look forward to fully vetting, you know, that product. But at this point, just, you know, if you can share with us, you know, what you've been up to, what the group has been up to, what are the broad contours of the areas you've explored, and perhaps a little bit about what might be coming forward.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani. And I want to thank you for making the work group opportunity available to me. I think it did accomplish in many ways what I hoped to accomplish in the bill that created it. We did begin a good conversation, I think, with the Minnesota Department of Education about how to address some of the issues that we faced in alternative schools. This is in some ways similar to some of the information you heard from Representative Reinert, in that we were looking for a broader kind of look at how our schools are doing. One of the frustrations for alternative schools is that when we were forming and created in the 70s and early 80s to really deal with the problems of at-risk students in a variety of areas, when time came to face up to the testing and No Child Left Behind, No Child Left Behind kind of ignored the existence of alternative programs and their mission and what they were doing. So what happens to our programs is that because we have a population that must be at risk in some way, and we're judged being successful based on our student success, it puts us in a difficult category. So almost all of our schools are reported as failing schools because we only look at the student success. That's not to say that we don't believe that students should be assessed or that the testing should happen. We certainly should look at the academic success of students, and we should be paying attention to that and making sure that students are being successful. But our programs were created so that we could help students deal with emotional, social, or other kinds of issues in their lives, and assist them with chemical dependency and mental health issues that are not measured by those tests. And we believe that if there's a way to show that our schools are meeting those particular goals, the public should know about that too. And if they're going to say, well, your students are not being academically as successful, but we understand that the reason for that may be because of all of these other issues that they're facing, and you're doing a good job in helping them make progress there so that they can be successful academically in school. And that's kind of the gist of our conversation. So we began our work group by listening to the department report on how they assessed alternative schools, and they confirmed that it's no different than any other school. They assess them the same way. And then we heard from various alternative school educators and administrators about how they are meeting the needs of these students and getting examples of problems that these students face in their lives, and many of them living on the kind of the edge of survival in their daily life, some of them, and the fact that they make it to school is an example of great heroic effort, and we applaud that. And then on top of that, we want to make sure that they are able to earn a diploma and move on in life. So that the in the work group, we also heard some proposals from people about how we might assess our programs in a different way to give that information to the public. And that's really the gist of the bill, which you'll hear more about when I come before you with and present it. Are there any questions about what we talked about?
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Bly, our lead minority party member. I was also a member of that group, and I don't know, Representative Erickson, you want to add anything? We will, of course, be hearing this bill sometime soon, and we'll have a much fuller vetting. I want to thank you for participating in that as well. Very good. I learned quite a bit, Representative Lai. I thought I knew a lot about alternative schools. I learned that I still have a lot more to learn about them. Some pretty courageous efforts out there in Minnesota, working with young people that in many instances, unfortunately, you know, large parts of society have kind of walked away from. And so it was a real privilege to hear of their work, and I look forward to vetting your bill in this committee and going forward from there.
Thank you.
Thank you for your leadership on this. And then next, Denise, were you? Okay, Representative Dietrich has been a little busy during the interim period of time. Among a number of things that she's been working on is another working group, a formal working group of the committee, our high school redesign working group. And so, Representative Dietrich, if you can share with us what you and the working group have been up to.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to chair this committee. I thought I knew a lot about high school, having three boys in high school and being on the school board and that type of thing, but once again, you start delving into a topic like this, and you, all you learn is that you don't know very much and that there's so much more to learn. And then I want to thank you for the opportunity to report back as to the work that we did and what we have learned. I think that is very important, especially in this topic. As you know, I carried the high school redesign bill last session, and it became very obvious to me as I was carrying that bill that we in the state of Minnesota are not yet at a point where we are all, I don't think, convinced that our high schools need to be redesigned. So if you don't mind, what I would like to do today is I would like to try to make a case for high school redesign, since this is the policy committee. And I think that, I know that that is what we spent a lot of our time on in our committee, was actually trying to decide, do our high schools really need to be redesigned? Are they obsolete? And so I would like to just make sure that we include some of those conclusions. So it is going to be a little bit more detailed than the previous two, is really what I'm trying to say, so
go,
be ready.
Go for it,
thank you. our research, first of all, the process, it consisted of 8 hearings. It consisted of a fact-finding trip to Little Rock, Arkansas, where I was joined by Representative Swales and Representative Vince Brown. And an incredible trip, and we learned so much, and I hope to share more with each of you individually about that trip. We shared information on the national level. We heard from national experts and organizations in the field of high school redesign. We listened to state leaders in the field of high school redesign, and of course, then what we did was we looked at our own programs that we have going right in the state of Minnesota within our own high schools. Today I'd like to highlight some of the conclusions that we came to in regard to the future projections of changing demographics, employment trends, and the assessment data of how our middle and high school students are doing. So I'm going to try to run through these as quickly as I can. First of all, many of you have already heard some of these, but I think it is still really important to highlight. We are going to have fewer high school students in the future. And meanwhile, our labor's workforce is projected to be, the jobs are projected to be at historic lows. The jobs that are going to be available are going to require more education. We are going to see a 20% increase in jobs requiring at least some post-secondary education by 2012, which is not that far away. We are going to see an increase in science and technical jobs. Economic forecasts project a 20 to 30% increase in scientific and technical occupations in the next 10 years. We are going to have a more diverse and lower income students. Between now and 2018, Minnesota is going to realize 193% increase in African American students, 470% increase in Hispanic students, and these students are sorely underrepresented in academic coursework of rigor that will prepare them for post-secondary experience. We have rapidly changing demands in the labor market. According to Deed, we are currently preparing students for jobs that don't exist using technologies that have not been invented in order to solve problems that we do not even know what are problems right now. And then, of course, we have the global competition. In China, 25% of the population with the highest IQs is greater than the total population in North America. Thus, China has more honor kids than we have kids. There is an inadequacy of current high school skills here in the state of Minnesota. According to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, 68% of the chamber's businesses that responded to a survey indicated that their job openings are very difficult to fill. And then, as if that is not enough, more teachers are going to be needed. Over the next 10 years, more than 56,000 new teachers are going to be needed. That's an increase of 36% to account for the growth in turnover in the teaching occupation. Now on to a little bit about the assessment data here in the state of Minnesota. In math, in 2007, 58.7 of the eighth graders in Minnesota scored meet or exceed standards on MCA2s. For 11th graders, that rate dropped to 32%. I don't know about you, but that sends a red flag to me that our high schools might not be meeting the needs of the students as well as the earlier years. And when you break that down by ethnicity, the numbers are daunting. For African Americans, 25%, 26% for American Indians, 35% for Hispanics, 63% for whites, 70% for Asian Pacific Islanders. And that rate at the 11th grade level even dropped further for the ethnicities, for the different ethnicities. In reading, we do not fare as poorly. But for the different ethnic groups, it is still pretty dismal. Graduation rates. In 2006, 38% of African American high school students graduated. Hispanics, 39%. American Indians, 40%. Asians, 68%. And whites, 80%. And according to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, we need, because of the demographics that I just described, we need every student in the state of Minnesota to be graduating and to be prepared for a post-secondary experience. The importance of math, we've all been talking about it, and so I'm sure it's no surprise, but mathematics is a key indicator of college success. And it has been concluded that the tipping point towards successful completion of a bachelor's degree is now firmly above algebra. And this does pose a problem for the state of Minnesota. During 2003-2004 school year, just 46% of our 9th through 12th graders took an upper-level math course. In science, 29% of our high school students took at least one upper-level course. And when you look at other states across the country, that number is more towards 40%. On an international comparison, according to the PISA exam, our 15-year-olds performed significantly below their peers in other developed countries in both mathematics and science, and scored average in reading. Some of the conclusions that we have come to based on the information that I have, the summary of some of the information that I have just presented to you, is that post-secondary education has become increasingly important to Minnesota's continued economic success and prosperity and global competitiveness. Jobs in the past that only required a high school degree will now require at least some post-secondary experience. You can, and when we talk about post-secondary, we are talking about 1 year, 2 year, 4 year, and beyond programs. And so what have we concluded that Minnesota needs? Well, there are many different things, and we can get a little bit more detailed, but what I want to really emphasize is I think that Minnesota needs a renewed vision for education in the state. We need to bring all of Minnesota stakeholders together and decide what is it that Minnesota's high school graduates need when they graduate. And we need to, the reason that we need a renewed vision is because we have come to some conclusions throughout this process, and that is that the current process, the current high school system right now, is inequitable. There are some kids getting a really, really, really excellent high school education and experience, and then there are many who are being left behind. And so we need a renewed interest in our high schools, and we need to decide what is going to be adequate for every student in the state and accessible to every student in the state. And, of course, once you decide, that all has to be encompassed by many of the things that we have talked about already. The program needs to be rigorous, no matter what type of pathway a student is taking. We need effective relationships in the schools, and that we need to make learning more relevant to the 21st century. Some of the options that we would like to consider in the future is we would like to increase the amount of rigor in our high schools. And we have defined rigor, and I think this is something else that we need to do as a state, as externally recognized attainment. So that would, we need to expand the access to advanced placement, ID, honors courses, rigorous career technical programs. And when we talk about expand the access, what we are really talking about is the middle and the lower end learners. We've talked about that earlier. There are some kids that are already getting an excellent education, but we need to figure out the way to get all kids with a rigorous high school experience. We need to increase the number of kids taking pre-AP, pre-IB. And there are many people out there throughout the United States and some in the state of Minnesota who have figured out how to do that. There are great programs out there like AVID, Navigation 101, other type of programs that hit the middle child, get every child engaged in planning their high school experience so that they are prepared to be successful in a post-secondary experience. So that, Mr. Chairman, is a lot of what we have learned. I would like to thank the committee members who have participated in this process. It is Representative Brown, Representative Benson, Representative Swales, Representative Detmer, Representative Tilbury, Representative Welty, Representative Erickson, and Representative Demmer were the work group members, and I would like to thank them for participating in this process. And I would stand for any questions.
Thank you. We do have a question, I believe, from Representative Wardle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dietrich, I know states where the percentage you take higher math is 46% or in the 40s, higher than we are in Minnesota. Did they say why? Were they state mandates because it may be 4 years of math instead of two or three, or just students like math better than it was?
Excellent question, and I am so thrilled that you asked. I didn't hear that last part, but I think that's okay. I am so glad that you asked. I think it is a combination of things, and that's why I say that we need a renewed vision in the state of Minnesota. When we went to, and I'm just going to tell this story because I can't hardly talk about this subject without talking about it. When Representative Swales and Representative Brown and myself went to Little Rock, Arkansas, people around the state were saying, what in the world are you going to Little Rock to look at education? Minnesota is the education state. They should be coming here. And so we kind of went with a little bit of that apprehension. And once we got there, we realized that the state of Arkansas has laser-focused vision on improving their high school experience for all of their kids, for the whole state. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that they did, they passed a law that said every high school in the state of Arkansas has to teach, not offer, teach four AP classes. Now, and just a little side note, we are talking one of the poorest states in the country. And you go out to the, you can imagine some of their rural high schools, they have 100% poverty. And when they passed that law, they talked about the kickback that they got throughout the whole state from parents, kids, teachers, everybody just said, those kids in rural parts of Arkansas cannot take AP. They're not ready. They can't pass it. And so they said, well, handle it how you would like, but you're going to teach it. And the other thing is that they have something called a Smart Core program. and that is an opt-out program. And it's a series of classes that you would want your child, and this is geared towards the parent, toward the family. These are a series of choices you might want to make for your child if you want them to be ready for some sort of post-secondary experience. And you have to opt out of it. The family does. 10% of the families in the whole state opt out. But, and I have to also say, it's comprehensive because they have also embarked on a media campaign that talks to parents in a way, in a time that parents can listen. It's on the radio, it's on TV, and it is short snippets about if you want your child to be prepared, you want to enroll them in the Smart Core program. And if you don't, you might be making some choices you might regret for your child.
Very quick, Representative Wardwell, please.
I think they probably did some pre-AP type courses down in the middle school level, and marketing ideas, great.
Another excellent program, excellent question. When we went to the second high school that we visited, they talked about, they started with AP, and she said, the principal said, if I could do it all over, what I would do is start with pre-AP and pre-ID so that the kids were prepared, and start with AVID very early. But they are pretty far down the process. Representative Swells, Representative Brown, do all of their kids participate in AVID? No? Okay. But they have it as a clear goal that they are going to aggressively increase the number of kids taking AP. So
that's the ratio, Representative Wardwell. Representative Hornstein, and then Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dietrich, for your excellent work. You mentioned the shortage of teachers. I also wanted to see if your group also discussed counselors and the work that I did on that bill last year, and now having a senior in high school and very aware of the importance of counselors and career and college planning, offering those kinds of options and opportunities for students. Has that come up, and do you have thoughts or recommendations on the whole sort of college and career counseling area of high school?
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. When we started to digest all this information on high school redesign, we had to make some. We had to decide how were we going to approach the subject first of all, and then what were we going to do with all this information. And the members of the committee felt very strongly that we needed a comprehensive approach to high school redesign, and everybody on the committee saw there is a real lacking in the state of Minnesota, first of all, just in the number of counselors, and then how a real missed opportunity for our kids to get some sort of one-on-one mentoring discussion about what are my career plans. And then the second question is, then what classes do I take? If these are some interests that I have for a career, then what are the classes I might want to be taking? And, we have many stories, but we were just in Albert Lea in Representative Brown's area, and their Chamber of Commerce talked about that also. They have great workforce opportunities for their students, but what they are finding is once they get out of high school that they might have made the wrong choices in order to prepare them for the jobs that they want to be in. And so then that puts the parents and the school system in a real odd situation. So the only way to do that is to make better use of the staff that we already have. Many of us already have some sort of advisory type periods in our high schools. There are like the Navigation 101 program that is done statewide in Washington. They utilize the advisory positions, but in like the state of Arkansas and that type of thing, they have people who sit down with kids before school, after school, anytime, and sit down and pass and create a pathway to their career.
Thank you.
Representative Abler, and then I'm actually going to move ahead. There are a number of others, but I do want to get through this agenda. If there's time, I'll come back to the others as well, but this is going to be a standing item for this committee, and I don't know if you have specific legislation you're proposing this year. But if not, I mean, I think that this is the stuff that really forms the center of much of our work here as a policy committee. And so I do look forward to continuing this discussion over the long haul. Let's send it over.
Mr. Chairman, it's amazing how quick 5 minutes goes by in one of these reports. Just I'll convert my question to a brief comment. I think it would behoove us as we work on this really important thing that Denise has come across to separate the free stuff from the stuff that requires money. And I think that, you know, the free thing certainly could go forward in focus and directions and freedoms for districts, et cetera. That's short enough. Thanks.
Thank you. I suspect most things are going to cost money one way or the other, but look forward to making that distinction. And obviously, you know, there are sort of community-wide efforts that are involved in this as well. Representative Dietrich, I really, again, appreciate your leadership. You mentioned the committee members are very active, but I also appreciate the passion that you bring to this. And I think, you know, you keyed in on the key word here in terms of vision. Oftentimes I feel like part of what we do is really kind of caretaking, and that's not a bad thing to do in and of itself. We do have a K-12 system that we need to nurture and tend to, but I think part of our calling here and our responsibilities as legislators is also to engage with the public in terms of developing visions that keep pace with the way our societies are growing, our economies are changing, and your work very clearly is very much about having that finger on that pulse of change in society. So I appreciate your passion, I appreciate your vision in this work.
Mr. Chairman, if I may close with just one observation, is that when I first started down this path, I thought that I was going to take it from the framework of a global economy, that we have to be competing with China and India, and this is what we need to do. But now that I have, I feel like really researched this for the past 6 months, it isn't, I don't think that we necessarily have to, our immediate worry is China and India. I think it is really some other states who have a real strong focus and a vision for their high schools, and they are on that path, and the whole state is on board. And then, Mr. Chairman, I cannot close without saying thank you for your wisdom in setting aside this committee. I think that it was very wise. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. I'm going to make a change in the agenda here. Representative Bly, I'm going to ask you to come forward with your bill. I think it's important for us to get this through. Dr. Bybee, I promise we will get you in here, and we will have substantive time for our discussion with you. But Representative Bly, if you can come forward. And Representative Dietrich, if you can move House File 2617 to be recommended to pass. And I believe we're referring this to the floor. Representative Dietrich so moves. The bill is before us. Representative Live.
Senator Mariani, as an English teacher, it's been confirmed for me the importance of language in this bill. And we were only moments ago coming to agreement on the language, and thanks to Lisa Larson for her work in helping us put this together.
Representative Bly, the legislative process is a process of constant humility for those who are involved in it. So.
The purpose of this bill is to remedy an unexpected outcome of the legislation passed last year. And in effect would allow the Board of Teachers to grant permission to unlicensed teachers to teach early childhood family education courses. And I've invited Lois Engstrom here to talk a little bit about the importance of moving towards licensure for these teachers. So I think without further ado, I'll let her say her.
Ms. Engstrom, it's very good to see you again, and but I'm going to warn you, I'm going to yield a very heavy gavel here because I do want to get to Dr. Bybee's presentation. So, but please, give us your name and your testimony.
My name is Lois Engstrom, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association for Family and Early Education, or usually called MNAFI. You hear that title. And the bill that was passed last year did have unintended consequences, and so made everybody very intent on making sure that this works. And so all the people who worked to put it together, I think we know what it actually means. The two issues important to us is that we do have a standard for parent education teachers. We want licensed teachers. Everything indicates that the best outcomes come when you have the best qualified staff.
for the parents or for the children. The other, so we like that part of it. And the provisions are extremely important in various parts of Minnesota. There are simply no licensed parents educators. Early childhood teachers are a little bit easier to find. And so we do need the variances for that purpose, for scarcity, and also to be able to hire teachers who match the culture of the participants.
Thank you.
And then I would, Chair Mariani, I would like to have Chair Mansky address the issue that we're trying to remedy.
Very good. Ms. Mansky, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And you heard my my encouragement for Ms. Engstrom in terms of brevity. Greatly appreciated at this point. But thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Chair Mansky, and I'm currently the coordinator of the Chicago Lake Family Center, but I spent 16 years as the coordinator of Bemidji's early childhood programming, and then actually was 3 years in Black Tech before that. So I'm here speaking today as the outstate Minnesota representative, and it's very true that the programs in outstate Minnesota, because they're so small and they have part-time staff, that the difficulty in getting a person licensed, particularly in parent ed, would eliminate some programs if they were required to do that. We certainly seek to have licensed parent ed and early childhood instructors, and we'll get licensed teachers whenever possible, but there were some small programs that just would close. Black Tech would have been one of those, and there were several in the area of Bemidji, and even Bemidji, which had Bemidji State, where we could get licensed in early childhood, Bemidji State dropped their parent ed licensing program, so there was virtually no place in the area, so it was really difficult.
Thank you, Ms. Mansky. It is indeed a big state and a very diverse state with different challenges, and I think often we perhaps create unintended consequences in our desire to do good things, but that's what we're here for, is to make adjustments, to stick to principle, but then also make a workable public policy that meets the needs of small towns like Greater Minnesota. We have, I think, two questioners here for the testifiers. Is that right, or should we hold off? Representative Rudolph?
Thank you, Chairman, Representative Bly, the testifier. I've got actually a few questions, short ones though. Why is there a shortage, do you think, in this area?
Representative Bly, or Ms. Fancy?
Well, I'll respond to that. I think because it's an additional license beyond. For example, I was licensed as an elementary teacher, and in order to continue in early childhood, I had to go on to get my early childhood license. Many people get it as master's level degrees. So that would be part of the problem. It's a more specialized license.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned about, you know, what are the qualifications? I mean, we're crossing out qualified, and we're talking about, you know, licensed teachers. What are the qualifications then for being in this?
Ms. Benson, before we do that, perhaps we should move your amendments before us so we can properly discuss it. Representative Dietrich, would you be so kind as to move the A4 amendment?
So moved.
Thank you. So the amendment is before us. Let me see if I remember how to do this. I think do we need to vote on moving the amendment before us? Is that, or placing it before us? I think we do, because it's an amendment that's being offered. I think basically this is going to put this in the shape you want it before us, but if you're not in the committee, we're going to vote on this. So all in favor of the Dietrich amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So the bill is before us as amended. Ms. Engstrom, if you can then pick up on Representative Rudolph's question in terms of this issue of what's happening here with the changing from licensure to, what's the other language we're using here? Qualified to license.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rudolph, the license has a number of different requirements, and as you can probably imagine, they have, the parent educators need to have all the early childhood development and everything that we'd expect of an early childhood teacher. Plus, they have family systems, family dynamics. There are group facilitation skills. There's a whole piece about ethics in terms of working with families. There's obviously family psychology. There is adult education. A big skill is facilitation skills, because it's not a lecture kind of thing, but facilitating groups where you bring out the issues from the families and also build upon their strengths. It's a very strength-based focus, and that isn't always typical of a lot of different areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Virgo.
Thank you. Just a, I don't know if there's a question, but a comment. Yesterday, somebody gave a speech talking about, you know, raising quality of our teachers and education, and this is a concern of mine as well, and I'd like to commend Representative Dietrich for the efforts that she has bringing forward. It ties in with some things that I've been thinking about, and it concerns me that we're not raising quality if we allow, if we essentially lower qualifications, which I think in some areas we're doing. We have math teacher shortages, science teacher shortages, and we're kind of putting band-aids on these things. Frankly, I would like to see teachers, all teachers, especially those starting out, actually come out with master degrees in their field. I think we have to look more and more at ways in which we can raise the qualities of our teachers and doing it through education. And if we have to put some band-aids now, I guess we have to, but we have to look at the systemic problem that we have of raising the quality of our teachers in this state and the education system that we have.
Representative Welty has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bly. Representative Ertl, Representative Dreiling, and I have been working on a science licensure issue, and I know why Representative Ertl is asking these questions, and I look at this bill, and I have a lot of questions now, because I've been going through the science licensure process, and I can tell you, members, I would just be cautious on this, because as soon as we start changing licensure, we're going to have people coming from both sides. You're going to have people who are currently teachers that are going to come to you, and they're going to say, is this fair? I got a license, I'm teaching, and now we're going to make it easier for people to come in and teach in the field that I'm licensed in. And so you can easily put something in place where essentially the pendulum goes too far in the other direction, and that's what we're working on right now. And so my first question to you is, could you please, Representative Bly, give me the history of where this licensure was at, how long ago, where is that now, and what this change will do? And then the second thing is the second question I have is, you're talking about the Board of Teaching granting a variance, but you have nothing in here that states how long that variance can be in place. So I would like to know the answer to that. Is it a 3-year variance? Is it a variance for the entire time that the person's going to be teaching? I mean, I understand this issue from both sides, from the rural perspective in Greater Minnesota, and it is difficult to find people to try to find these, fill these part-time positions. But then I also see it from the point of view of a teacher saying, I've been licensed in this area, and now there are other individuals that are going to be coming into these places where I had to work to get my degree.
Representative Bly.
Representative Welty, you hit upon the complexity of this issue. And why I think we had difficulty talking with the various stakeholders to try to get the language right. The Board of Teaching is governed by rules and how long that they grant these variances and waivers. And those rules will be in place. And the goal is still to move towards the licensure and ask those people who get these waivers and variances that they will be seeking those licenses. But it was really to remedy the problem where there were people who might lose their job or programs that would have to shut down. I mean, a program is better than no program, I think, in this case. And certainly we want to move towards the quality that you're talking about, but recognizing that to cause harm to some programs and to some folks is not the intention of the move. And it allows really school boards or schools, not individuals, to ask for these variances and waivers. But I want to have Lois Engstrom speak to the history of this because she knows more about that than I do, if that's all right.
Again, Ms. Engstrom, if you can be brief, I'm going to ask Karen Ballmer, I believe she's here, and perhaps this might be a good opportunity for you to weigh in on this. Ms. Engstrom.
Representative Welty, what we've got now is simply getting in writing with more clarity what had always been true since about 1985. And so it had a pattern of working, but it wasn't spelled out. And then last year's language, which is I take a lot of blame for because I worked on that and convinced Nora that saw it that you know, we'd have this all, this had been gone through the whole hearing process with everything to be a state board rule, of, you know, the State Board of Education, was ready to just be passed when the State Board was abolished. And so therefore we didn't have anything really in language, but that had been there, and I didn't realize what the implications were of not spelling out the part about provision. This just takes us back to where we were. It's not raising or lowering, it's just clarifying.
Ms. Barber, perhaps you can come forward and offer your perspective from the Board of Teaching. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Ballmer, Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Teaching. Fantastic questions are being raised. Specific to this issue, I can tell you that right now the way the Board of Teaching is treating ECSU programs is different and inconsistent with all other licensure fields. In all licensure fields, there's the opportunity for special permissions, which includes things like variances, waivers, community experts. Because of language that was passed last year, it prohibited, because it explicitly stated two licenses, it prohibited us from offering those permissions and more. So right now we're treating this licensure field differently than any other licensure field. Specific to the questions are good ones. Why do we need these permissions? Don't we want fully licensed teachers in every classroom? Yes, we do. The application, when the application comes to us, it comes from not an individual teacher, but a charter school or a public school district administrator. They must attest to the fact that they have advertised, they've recruited, they have not been able to find a fully licensed teacher for that position. So it's not a situation that, whereby they just choose to not have a fully licensed teacher, although there are instances where they do choose someone who is non-licensed for very good reasons, maybe working towards licensure. So there are those rare instances, but they must disclose that information on the application. So, and just finally, as a piece of context for some data, I looked back at the last 5 years in terms of the numbers of people, how many people are on permission. So for the early childhood education permissions, and this includes a number of different types of permissions, over the last 5 years, we had a range of 29 to 60 over the last 5 years, that range. And in total, we had 1,922 total licenses last year in that field. So that gives you a little sense of the scope of the issue. The other licensure field that we're talking about today is parent and family ed. Over the last 5 years, the number of permissions total has ranged from 40 to 49, and the number of total valid licenses last year was 1,883. So again, these are not large numbers of permissions that are going out, but they are in hardship situations where a district or charter school, in this case it would be a community ed program, has not been able to find an appropriately licensed person for that position. And I answer any questions.
Representative Welty, was your you had a number of very good questions there. Was your question about the length of the variance when the variance was created for Ashley Palmer? You can briefly say something about that.
Thank you. Yes, each application is for a duration of 1 year. And then, with the exception of one application, which is called a non-renewable, this is for a fully licensed teacher who is enrolled in a preparation program. They're working towards licensure in that field. We give them a window of 3 years when they can demonstrate that they've been enrolled, they're already licensed, working towards another field. All others have a one-year limit.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ballmer, as I understand it, you can the board can come back to you and request another variance after that 1 year, or school district or the administrator, correct?
Representative Welty, yes, that's correct.
Okay, so Ms. Ballmer, how many years could a administrator come back and request this variance year after year?
Ms. Ballmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, there are limits on some of the permissions. Generally, the ones that have limits are for up to 3 years, and there is an appeal process whereby they can request a fourth. The non-licensed community expert is the exception to that, whereby there is no limit. That's in statute. Community expert permission was enacted by the legislature, and we offer that, but there is no limit to the number of community expert permission. I will tell you that around the board table in recent months, there has been growing concern about that, and they have been asking us staff to communicate to the districts and charter schools that have been coming back repeatedly to communicate strongly that we want these folks licensed if they intend to continue in that capacity.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ballmer, the insertion of the word licensed, I question when it's not specific to a content area such as early childhood, because the definition of teacher in law is that you must be licensed by the Board of Teaching. So why are we placing licensed in front of teachers in the amendment on line 1.5? When I read in statute, teacher means a classroom teacher or other similar professional employee required to hold a license from the Board of Teaching. Before, you know, I think in the previous language, it was specific to a particular licensure, that of early childhood or parent education. But now I question, isn't it redundant? If a teacher must be licensed, why is it licensed teacher? I mean, I just need that clarification.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson.
Ms. Ballmer.
It can go either way. If I believe that there, for our purposes, we don't need that word there. Some of our other stakeholders may feel that word is important. So that thus the second line that's been added in the amendment that you have before you to clarify the board's role in it. But for our purposes, that word is could be there or not.
Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson. You're good?
I actually want some. Just very quickly. I was going to make a comment that I'm concerned always that we get these variances.
Representative Peterson, you might want to use the mic just for the record. Yeah. Apologize for interrupting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that, you know, we've been giving waivers and variances for a long time in all areas of teaching, and we have to be moving away from that. And it does concern me that we continue to give these, and we have to require, after hearing Representative Dietrich's presentation and Representative Erdahl's comments, we have to require licensed teachers specific to their areas in the future if we're going to have a teaching corps that can meet the needs of the students in the future. Just a comment.
Representative Gottwald and then Representative Demmer, and then I'm going to take a vote on this bill, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. I have heard in talking with these CSE people that this is a challenge in rural areas, in the outstate areas, and I appreciate this bill's approach to be somewhat flexible. The need is urgent. We have lost a set of parenting skills. Some of you know I've been a big advocate of parental engagement, and ECFE is one of those programs that gets at this very significantly, and we are having a hard time finding fully licensed people. I think getting people who are on the way to licensure, people who have an interest in this area for a limited time, to be able to provide their expertise and skills to people in need of parenting skills is vitally important right now. I understand the concerns about licensure and getting people to licensure, but I appreciate the flexibility this bill offers, and I think it's a good measure that we need for ECFE.
Thank you. Well said, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ballmer, just a quick question about licensure. I understand there's a K-6 license, and then there's a pre-primary license. Could you clarify for me what's currently in statute now? When we say license to teach early childhood and parent education, does that mean that I don't remember what's called, but the before K-12 license, is that what that is currently?
Ms. Palmer.
Or what's the difference between those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, no, they're not the same thing. The license which you refer is pre-primary, and it is for ages 3 to 5, basically, and it's an endorsement that is generally added to an elementary license. For example, given the language of last year, we've not been recognizing that endorsement as a viable route for the ECSE programs. It is generally a shorter course of study than a full licensure program, because the scope is restricted to ages 3 to 5.
Representative Bly, your final comment?
Thank you for hearing the bill, and I think we've reached a compromise that does both remedy those hardships, but also move us towards the quality licensure that we're trying to get to.
Well done, Representative Bly. Members, just to clarify, because the chair is a little rusty, the previous motion was simply to put this language, typical of us to do a courtesy of the author to have the language before us the way in which the author would prefer to have it before us. Obviously, the amendment has raised some issues for members, and I want to make sure that we're clear that what we did was a procedural courtesy to make sure that we have before us for an eventual vote the bill as the author intends it for us to be voted on. So, the motion then recurs. Representative Dietrich renews her motion that House File 2617, as amended, be recommended, passed, and referred to the general order on the floor. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bly and Ms. Nancy, Palmer, and Ms. Engstrom. Finally, members, I'm going to ask Dr. Bybee to come forward. And members, I'm going to ask a little bit of your indulgence. You know, we got off to a late start because we didn't have a quorum until about 8:13 or so. And I know that we've got pressing things after this meeting, but I want to make sure that Dr. Bybee, who's traveled a distance to be here with us today, has sufficient time to be able to share with us what he intended to share with us. And so I would ask for your courtesy in terms of hanging around perhaps a little bit later than our German time, but not too much later, so that we can have a good discussion and presentation from Dr. Bybee. Dr. Bybee, welcome to the committee, and you're accompanied by a very good person here.
Representative Mariani, I'm Nancy Nutting, Executive Director of CIMAS Minnesota. We're pleased to have Dr. Bybee with us yesterday for our annual policymaker briefing and to share him with this committee this morning. I'm going to do a very short introduction. You have a black folder with some of the proceedings from our event yesterday, a copy of A Decade of Action, which is a report on a synthesis of recommendations from business, industry, and government, and my contact information if there's additional information you need after the meeting today, you or your legislative staff. There's also an additional PowerPoint presentation in your folder. Dr. Bybee is Executive Director of BSCS, which stands for Biological Services Curriculum Study. It's a nonprofit organization that develops curriculum materials, provides professional development and research and evaluation for the science education community. He is a nationally and internationally known expert in science education and in the broader field of STEM education. He has been a leader in the development of the National Science Education Standards, which I think is important as Minnesota moves towards its revision of its current science standards. He has served as chair of the Science Forum for Peace of 2006 and is the science expert group, chair of the science expert group for that group that is related to some of the data that Representative Dietrich shared with you. He is not a stranger to Minnesota. He has taught in the Northfield Schools and has been a professor at Carleton College, living in Minnesota for over 15 years. So I'm pleased to present Dr. Bybee to you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Bybee.
Chairman Mariani, thank you for the invitation. I appreciate being back, and as Nancy mentioned, I did live in Minnesota for 15 years, so I feel a little closer to Minnesota than just kind of fly in and say a few words and move on. In the interest of time, I'm going to kind of accelerate through the slides, but I'll make my points beginning, and I want to support what Representative Dietrich said. Much of what I am going to talk about, or my message today, has to do with the urgent need to prepare all students as citizens for the 21st century workforce. Now, there are a lot of details behind that. I'm going to kind of give some information both about Minnesota and about PISA. By my count, Representative Dietrich said every student five times in her testimony. And I really want to focus on every student. We have adequate numbers, and we'll continue to have adequate numbers of scientists, engineers, technologists, and so on. Those individuals will go through school. They will be supported by AP courses, IB courses, and so on and so forth. The most pressing need is for the students who are going to be entering the workforce and may be at some deficit in their reading, their writing, their arithmetic, their science, their technology, etc. So that's what I want to focus on. So leave the message at the beginning. Education is going to be part of, not the entire solution, the economic problems in this country and in the state of Minnesota. But it's got to be part of the solution. And I think we have some opportunities to move forward and begin responding to that. Let me give some background information that may be of interest. These are available. I am just going to click through a number of these slides. I'm sure that you're familiar with Rising Above the Gathering Storm and the American Competitiveness Initiative. These are major reports. The Rising Above the National Storm is from the National Academy of Sciences, the National Research Council. Major representatives from business and industry gathered to say we must address the issue of training individuals for the 21st century workforce. American Competitiveness is the initiative sponsored by the current administration. Those were kind of either federal or government reports. There's also popular reports. Thomas Friedman in The World is Flat is making the case that the world is flat because of technology. Representative Dietrich mentioned China, India, and so on. We need to attend to that. Also, it is the case that Thomas Friedman addressed the issue of education and termed it, if you go to the second line up from the bottom, that it is a quiet crisis. This country responded to the Sputnik crisis in the late 50s. That, by the way, was the origins of BSCS and development of programs. It is a quiet crisis now. The kind of competitor isn't as clear. At that time, it was the Soviet Union. Now, it's a little more diffuse. It's major competitors, and I will list those and mention some of those when I refer to PISA. A few things about the state of Minnesota, research that I did in anticipation of coming here that I think would need some attention. This is fourth grade science from 2005, and it's from the National Assessment of Educational Progress. The most startling thing that I would note is that the percentage of students below basic and at basic in the state, fourth grade science in 2005, was 66%, a significant number of individuals that are operating, that are functioning at basic or below. If you go to eighth grade science, there are 2 points that I want to make with this slide, actually three. Minnesota was above average in the national comparison. That's good. That said, 61% of the students were still below basic or at basic. The third point to make with this slide is in looking across the years, 96 to 2000 to 2005, basically achievement is flat in compared to the national averages. How can that be changed, adjusted, not just kind of statistical manipulation, but in real game scores by the students. I'm going to go past that. Here's another one, another slide that I went and looked at from the Progressive Policy Institute. They have a scale, 21 indicators of the economic viability of states. So this, the comparison you see there is Minnesota's rank among the 50 states. And the 21 indicators are classified in five different categories, and you see the categories on the left column. Globalization, transformation of the digital economy, and so on. You see the ranking of Minnesota on those. The overall ranking on for all scores compared to all states was 13th for Minnesota. In comparison to other states, Massachusetts was ranked first. The state of Washington, not Washington, D.C., was ranked second. California was third, and the state of Colorado was fourth. So you see who some of the, going back to Representative Dietrich's comments, you see some of the states with which Minnesota is in some economic competition. And you see some categories generally related to technology and associated disciplines and areas. These are some other things. I want to switch now to the PISA. I underscored the fact that we're talking about all students or every student. PISA is an assessment of all students at 15 years of age, and their scientific literacy is what I'm emphasizing here. Scientific literacy and the proficiencies that we assessed in PISA amounted to the individual at 15 years of age, their competency to, number one, identify scientific issues if confronted with a life situation or something such as a newspaper report, a report on television, something of that sort. Not a straightforward issue in physical science or life science, chemistry, so on and so forth. The second competency is their ability to explain phenomena scientifically. Not their opinion, not what they think, not what somebody else said, but a scientific explanation. The third is their ability, their competency to use scientific evidence as they would make a decision, write a report, form an argument, and so on. How did the United States do? The United States average, as you see in the top line, was 489. The average across OECD stands for Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. These are countries with which we are, the United States, is in competition, basically. There are 57 countries that participated in the 2006 assessment. 30 were OECD, 27 were non-OECD, other countries. 16 countries were measurably or statistically ahead of us. About in the middle, statistically, for the OECD countries. Just in a straight ranking, there were 20 countries ahead of us. And I think that's significant, and it should have all of our attention about the abilities, the competencies of students to perform on the competencies that I mentioned. We did, in scoring these competencies, group them into six levels of proficiency. The highest two levels, 5 and 6, are students who are genuinely gifted. They, if given a life situation that includes science, they know how to analyze it. They know where to go and find information. They can construct an argument or a discussion very well using evidence and so on. There's 9% of students in the United States are in that category. I would also mention those are probably the students that are going on into careers in science, engineering, technology, mathematics, and so on. A greater note is that while the United States has 9%, that's good news, other countries, Finland, New Zealand, Japan, for example, have significantly higher percentages of students. I would very highly recommend looking at Finland as a competitor, both economically and what they're doing in their educational system. Short story is they pay a lot of attention to their teachers, and they have very clear standards that their teachers are going to move the students toward and toward.
Dr. Bybee, we have an honorary Finn among us who, in fact, was in Finland a few months ago doing some exploring on these kind of issues. Representative Rudolph.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not finished, but I'm married to one, but she is taking pills for it. But I did spend a week in Finland in September and visited schools in Finland and tried to get some idea in talking to administration and to students why they are so successful. And dovetailing a little bit with what I talked about earlier, I asked the one of the administrators, why are your schools so good? And they said, teachers, teachers, teachers.
That's right.
And I said, well, what is so good about your teachers? And they said, well, every teacher has a master's degree in their field of study. In other words, an English teacher has an English master's degree, not in, you know, some other field. And they felt that that was critical in their success of their educational system. So I'm glad you are citing them today.
Yeah. Finland is a model country on PISA 2006 in science. They were basically off the scale, and so a lot of people are looking at paying attention to Finland. The insight is the teachers. They do also have clear standards that the teachers are very well aware of. The teachers have a great deal of autonomy to achieve those standards, but they're very clear about these are the standards that you're going to achieve. The opportunity here in Minnesota and in this country, I think, rests in professional development. For the teachers that are coming into the system, perhaps what Representative Yurdal said about kind of master's degree or setting a standard like that. But we also have millions of teachers in the system already. And that, I think, goes right directly to the important role of professional development and helping those teachers come to higher levels of understanding of their content areas. But also looking at the systems, whether it's the school or the district, to have one of the other insights from both the PISA and the PIMS reports in looking at high-achieving countries is attending to coherence within the educational system. What goes on in elementary schools is related to what goes on in middle schools, and what goes on in middle schools related to high school. This country also has, and this state, a lot of local districts making decisions, local jurisdictions have control, and that works basically against the coherence. A lot of different instructional materials, curriculum programs, emphases, and so on. When you look at high-achieving countries, Singapore, Finland, etc., they have a very coherent system. And I think that's worth noting and trying to kind of move toward in this country.
Well,
in the interest of time, I'm going to stop and maybe entertain any questions representing Mary Ruff.
Very well. I believe Representative Dietrich has a question.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have first a comment is that at some point in the last 6 months I heard that one of the reasons that Finland has moved so far so quickly is because they developed a vision, and they also then developed a 5 or a 10-year strategic plan
That's
on how they were going to get there.
Yes.
And everybody, it was very clear from the whole country's perspective what they were going to do and how they were going to get there. And then second of all, when you talk about their standards, could you quickly address, are they knowledge-based standards or are they higher-level type thinking standards, you know, the problem-solving, innovation, those types of things?
Yeah. Their standards include both. And the surprising thing that I found in looking at their standards is they're not as clear, actually, as well defined as, for example, the national standards in the United States. But I think the teachers' understanding of what the standards mean and the direction and the programs that they have support the higher levels of achievement. It's also the case that they underscore not just content areas, because in PISA, one of the things that we emphasize that also is emphasized in Finland and other high-achieving countries is the student's understanding of science, as is not just science knowledge. Do they understand density? Do they understand parts of the flowering plant and so on? But they also understand the role of inquiry. They know how to conduct inquiries. And that, by the way, is the other area where we have the opportunity right now to develop the skills and abilities relative to the 21st century workforce. Let me only digress for a minute. That to the degree our school science programs and technology programs have inquiry or design-based opportunities, laboratory investigations for the students, that those are the places that right now are recommendations for not only this committee but others to say, what can we do now? Immediately, we can help our teachers understand the opportunities they have when the students are doing laboratory investigations. That's where they can develop the hard skills. Those are from the labor economists. The hard skills such as critical thinking, problem solving, analyzing situations, etc. And the soft skills like interacting with other individuals, working in teams, reporting, reading, writing, and so on. Those opportunities exist now in programs in many of our schools. What we have to do, professional development theme, is help the teachers understand how they can engage the students in those abilities and skills in the context that they already have available. Because in most cases, the teachers are emphasizing, you know, if we're doing a laboratory, the outcome is going to be understanding density or Krebs cycle in biology or something like that. We don't want to ignore those, but we want to also emphasize the basic skills and abilities that are important for the 21st century workforce.
Mr. Warbaugh, I believe you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Representative Erdahl can answer some of them better than me. I've got four questions. Number one, what's the pay like for a teacher in Finland compared to the populace over there? Number two, do they have any teacher shortages or do they have plenty of teachers? Number three, how long is their school day, school year? And number four, how well are teachers expected over there? I know that when I walked around, if I told somebody I was a teacher, oh. If I told somebody I sell mutual funds, oh. You
know, what about anything your state legislature?
I avoid that question.
I would have to do more research. So I'm going to answer a couple of those that I do know from working on PISA and interacting with representatives from Finland. First of all, the teachers are respected. They're selected. The selective process to be a teacher is the criteria are high. And so they are respected in the community. Their pay, I just shouldn't comment on because I don't know. I don't believe there's a shortage. And their school years, if anything, are comparable to ours, are shorter. And that we find that internationally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just answering those questions, their pay is a little higher than the average here. And with their populace, they'd be... Oh, I guess I'm not sure about that. Their school day is a little bit shorter. Well, and just on the topic of respect, I mean, one thing that struck me when I went into the cafeteria, I'm used to paper flying around and food here and there, and the students get up and, you know, there's a pile of whatever on the tables, and having monitors walking around the lunchroom. There were, you know, a teacher's table, the students all eating quietly, talking to each other, and when they get up, they take everything, they throw everything in the waste basket, and they don't throw their forks in there, and they have forks. But I was struck by the respect and to the building itself and to the cafeteria.
Dr. Bybee, if you had to, and obviously we really need to spend like an hour at least with you on this, but if you were to do a very quick assessment of where Minnesota is, you've been here in the state, and perhaps Ms. Nutting, you might want to weigh in here as well, in terms of systemically the kind of things that we have in place here that can take us to the type of model that is being suggested through this exploration of other efforts around the globe. Where would you place us? Are we locally? We have a lot of work to do. Do we have enough of a good pieces in place? And Ms. Nutting, I mentioned you because, you know, we're going to be revising our standards soon, and I know you'll be heavily involved with that. I know you have some intimate knowledge of, you know, sort of assessing where we're at. But Dr. Bybee, your sense of where our state is at?
I think probably the findings from the economic index, the slide that I had earlier, would be a good indicator of not only the economic viability of the state vis-a-vis the things they looked at, but if you said kind of where are you ranking? And I did look at other factors. I flipped through some of the slides. I mean, like evaluation of the state standards, it's either a B or a C, depending upon which group you look at and what they're doing as criteria. I certainly would say that Minnesota is in easily in the top third or top quarter of other states in comparison. What I would also say, and I think this is probably more important than kind of where are you on the list of states, is that and looking at, thinking about, and spending several days here, the potential. It's like Minnesota's poised, ready to move in some direction. And I understand, and I do appreciate, I've been in education for 40-some years, that how complex all of the issues are, and certainly everybody that comes before this committee has their particular case, and this is what's really important. But to stay focused and move toward those things where you do have great potential, where you're kind of poised, ready to go. Revising the standards, I think, would be very, very important. And to pay attention to some of the top states as far as the achievement. And I mentioned some of those. Pay very close attention to Massachusetts and what they're doing and their standards. Pay close attention to other states. The state of Washington is currently in the process of revising their standards. But then also, it's very, very important, and will be for the state, to move from that policy level of standards to see that the programs that you have in place in school and the practices of teachers, if I could... I'm going to see if I can get to it quickly.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, let me do this very quickly. If you look at, this is a kind of, what are the dimensions of reform?
This is a separate handout inside the black
folder. Yeah, this is a separate handout, so you have it. And I'm not going to go through the whole slide. Just take one column. Go to the left column on time. And say, what is it we're doing? And let me locate the standards and some other things that at least I've heard talked about today. How much time does it take to bring about changes in the school system? And that's why looking at a decade is, I think you just have to look at a decade if you really want to have substantial changes in the school system. To reform the purpose, just either sit here or write something that says we have a new purpose, 21st century workforce, how long does that take? Very short period of time. 20, 30 reports from business and industry in a year or two. So that's pretty easy, it's fast, it's starting to signal what we ought to be doing. But if you move to policy, you're going to redo the standards, for example, and at least by my way of thinking, that is a policy document that guides science education in the state of Minnesota. How long will that take? A couple of years. You're starting now, and I think you have over a year that you're going to be in the process of rethinking and redoing your standards. So approximately 3 years or so to develop those and get those out. That also can be a statement for the public. They need to understand. The citizens need to understand why these new standards are important, not in some abstract educational ideal, why they're important for their children, and how these standards, as enacted in school programs and so on, will be important for their children as they go on to college, university, trade school, community colleges, etc. As I also would support what Representative DePietro said, that we need to no longer think of K-12 and then entry into the workforce. It's going to be K plus some post-secondary. If you go down through this, then to look at the policies have to be translated into programs, and those programs to be developed, that's 3 to 6 years, and then the practice, the critical element in this, I'm going to switch to the next slide here, is 7-10 years. So we've got to look at a decade of coherent action. The difficulties of reform you see here. The changes, if you go right to the bottom, changing the practices of classroom teachers, extremely high when you ask questions about what's the risk to them, what's the cost, and I mean in financial terms, of making the changes we're talking about. It costs a lot of money to put new programs in place. Think of the amount of money it costs to purchase new materials for all of St. Paul or Minneapolis. It's a lot of money. On the other hand, if you go through all of this, in the final column, the benefits to the school personnel, to the students, and so on, are extremely high when you get to the changes. To talk about new policies, to give speeches about new purposes, which I've been doing, the real benefit is minimal. It's as you move through the system and get down to the practices of teachers, that's where the real payoff is. And, you know, I wish I or some other people could say, well, you can do this without any cost. It's free. It isn't. But there could be a longer-term greater cost to the state and the country.
Well,
these are in the...
Thank you, Dr. Biber. I do apologize to you for the rushed nature of our schedule here. We had some...
No apologies.
Some circumstances that were perhaps, you know, it snows in Minnesota, sometimes it snows during the rush hour. And, but I do appreciate your traveling back here to Minnesota and spending time. You spent some time with the senators, I think, yesterday, was
yes.
it?
Yes.
And taking time this morning to be here with us, and I hope that we can continue this dialogue and learn
Thank
with you.
You.
Thank you. And Ms. Redding, it's always good to see you. And
you.
I look forward to working with you throughout the rest of this session.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
So, members, with that, we are adjourned until next week.